Stands beauty to be beautiful, there is already ugliness. When all the world understands goodness to be good, there is already evil. Thus, to be and not to be arise mutually. High and low are posited mutually. Long and short are compared mutually. And he goes through a whole list of opposites and show how they create each other. It's like that wonderful little parable. The Chinese character for man looks more or less like an upturned V. And Lafcadio Hearn, in one of his books, tells a story of a Japanese girl telling her little sister the meaning of the character for man by taking two sticks of wood and balancing them together on the ground, two sticks of firewood, so that they form the upturned V. And she says to her little sister, "This is the character for man, because neither stick will stand up unless it has the other to help it." And so, you know, we must dig each other. But the profounder meaning underneath this is there's no self without other. And no man, and don't forget, get back to the original point, every creature in the world feels it's a man. I don't mean a male, but a human. And that is because it is in this situation where the thing it feels as itself, as its separate identity, is supported by the equal and opposite sensation of other. Center, periphery. Here, there, now, then. Is, isn't, or whatever. These two are the yang and the yin, the two poles that hold each other up. So the Zen poem says, when misfortune comes, treat it as a blessing. When fortune comes, treat it as a disaster.
Sounds True presents Leave It Be, Session 6, Being in the Way, Part 2, with Alan Watts.
Once upon a time, there was a Chinese farmer who lost a horse, ran away. And all the neighbors came around that evening and said, "That's too bad." And he said, "Maybe." The next day, the horse came back and brought 7 wild horses with it. And all the neighbors came around and said, "Why, that's great, isn't it?" And he said, "Maybe." The next day, his son, I was attempting to tame one of these horses and was riding it and was thrown and broke his leg. And all the neighbors came round in the evening and said, "Well, that's too bad, isn't it?" And the farmer said, "Maybe." And the next day, the conscription officers came around looking for people for the army, and they rejected his son because he had a broken leg. And all the neighbors came round that evening and said, "Isn't that wonderful?" And he said, "Maybe." This, in a way, in a certain sense, reflects a fundamentally Taoistic attitude, which is that the whole process of nature is an integrated process of immense complexity, and it is really impossible to tell whether anything that happens in it is good or bad. Because you never know what will be the consequences of a misfortune, or you never know what will be the consequences of good fortune. I know a woman who was quite happy until she inherited $2 million. And then she became absolutely miserable because she was afflicted with paranoia that everybody was going to take it away from her, especially the government. And on the other hand, you've all known cases where some sort of ridiculous inconvenience or accident preserved you from a worse one, or else it was an occasion on which you met someone you fell in love with or formed a fast friendship with. You never know what is the chain, for the pattern, the connection between events. And it is for this reason that the Taoist has been critical of two things. One, of words, and two, of interference. He criticizes words because among the Confucians, who were always literary people, they had a thing going called the rectification of names. Now, I have to introduce this by a little observation about Confucians in general, because they have their positive and their negative side. But their negative side is their rather exclusive interest in matters literary. In the history of Chinese civilization, no kind of really scientific advance came through Confucian studies, because they were scholastics. That is to say, a scholastic is one who knows what's in the book and believes what the ancient texts or the ancient scriptures say, and he studies them and becomes proficient like a rabbi or a Christian theologian. But mystics are not interested very much in theology. All mystics have been interested in direct experience. And therefore, although you may laugh at them as mystics and say they are not scientific, they are empirical in their approach. And the Taoists, being mystics, were the only great group of ancient Chinese people who seriously studied nature. They were interested in it from the beginning, and their books are full of analogies between the principles of the Taoist way of life and the behavior of natural forces, of water, of wind, of plants and rocks. In many, many passages, Lao Tzu likens the Tao to water in the fact that it doesn't resist, and yet nothing is stronger, in the fact that it always takes the line of least resistance, that it always seeks the lowest level, which men abhor. And many, many things are said about water. Many things are said about plants. Many things are said about the processes of growth, about wind, how wind plays music with all the orifices and openings in nature and blows through them and brings out their particular hum. So it was, strangely enough, from the Taoists that Chinese people developed as much science as they did develop. But you know, they never developed anything like Western technology. And this is because, or in part because, there are many, many reasons, some of them purely geographical. But one of the reasons why the Chinese did not go on to develop an advanced technology had to do with names, and it had to do with a certain attitude to nature. Now, so far as names are concerned, the Taoists always laughed at the idea of the rectification of names, because they said, now look, when you compile a dictionary, you define your words with other words. Now, with what other words are you going to define the words with which you define the words, so as to be sure you've got them straight? I remember when I was a small boy, I wanted to write a book which would preserve forever the fundamentals of human knowledge. And so the first thing I wrote down in it was the alphabet. And then I scratched my head as how I would write down how to pronounce each of these letters. And I tried to spell out in letters how to pronounce letters, not realizing, of course, that this was a completely vicious circle. You have to have something in order to understand words. You have to have something else. And that is a very mysterious matter, the kind of understanding that we have of things, which we then go on to describe in words. And one realizes how much one learns as a child, especially from other people, which is never explicitly stated. How do you know, for example, whether somebody who says something to you is serious or kidding? A great deal of confusion is caused by that, even among adults. and how the processes have been examined and analyzed and studied, which are required for understanding the simplest sentence. And we don't yet know how the brain of a child accomplishes this extraordinary task, which when an analyst looks at it is extremely complicated. But of course you must realize that analysis is a way of making things complicated that were not complicated in the first place. And it was like my task that I set myself as a child, the amazingly complicated task of how to write down how the letters were pronounced. Now, a great deal of academic energy goes into this task of proving things that everybody knows. But they want to say precisely what thing is it that you know? How can we delimit it? How can we pin it down exactly? And this, of course, is very much involved also with law. And that's why you devise, bequeath, and, you know, you get a whole long list of words. I devise, bequeath, give, etc., etc., so that there can be absolutely no doubt about what you mean. But as a matter of fact, the trouble is, the more definite you become with words in describing something, the more doubt you create. And so the Taoists took a profoundly humorous attitude to the Confucians' interest in spelling things out, because they said, you can never do it. Do you ever play a game, any of you, called Vish? Well, the rules of this game are, you get, say there are five people playing, and you appoint a referee. Then each person has a copy of the same dictionary, say Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. And then you have many words in a hat or something, and the referee draws out a word. And he says, escalator. And then you turn it up in the dictionary. And then you get a definition, and you look up an absolutely key word in the definition. It has to be a really crucial word, not the or a or something. And then you look that up. And then you take a key word in that definition. And then when you get back to the word escalator, you raise your hand and call out Vish, which is short for vicious circle. And thereby you have won the round, and the referee is there to decide that you've played fair and that you did take key words from each definition and so on, and you didn't cheat. So this shows you, you see, how a dictionary, unless it has little pictures in it, which give you another way of understanding things, a dictionary is an entirely circular process, a simply a self-defining affair. So that when you encounter, say, I pick up a Chinese dictionary, or better still, for my purposes, supposing I pick up a Finnish dictionary, which has nothing in it but Finnish language, it doesn't tell me a thing, because I haven't got the key. And the key to this language is not altogether communicable in language. So for this reason, then, the Taoists were thoroughly skeptical of the power of words to describe the processes of the physical world. Now, the Chinese language as such is a rather peculiar language, unlike most other languages, in that it neither declines its nouns nor conjugates its verbs. There are certain ways sometimes of showing whether a verb indicates the future or whether it indicates the past, but in general, literally translated Chinese reads like a telegram. And so the opening of the chapter of the Lao Tzu book on De, that is to say on power or virtue, says in literal English, superior De, not De, thus this has De. Inferior De, or virtue, not let go of virtue, thus this not virtue. And this says it so succinctly. And we have to go bubbling around and saying, the superior form of virtue is not conscious of itself as virtue, and thus truly is virtue. But the inferior form of virtue so insists on being virtuous that it's not virtue. Well, that's a very complicated way of saying things, as the Chinese says it so pithily. But on the other hand, the Chinese language, which is not specific in this way that we can be by declining nouns and conjugating verbs, exactly what, how, and to whom, we have a better language, and so do the Japanese, because they have an arrangement for using Chinese in such a way as to decline the nouns and conjugate the verbs. We have a better language for describing technological processes. You know how it is when you get a set of instructions to put something together. First do this, then do that, then do the other thing. Well, boy, you should get some kind of a Chinese product from Hong Kong with put together instructions. And you just know where. You have to know how it's done before you read it. The compensatory delight of this language is that you can say several things at once and mean them all. However, the point now that we go on to is the second one. With this realization that language is a net which will never succeed in capturing the world, goes a reluctance to interfere with the processes of nature. Because what you think may be a good thing to do may be good only in the short run. It may turn out to be disastrous in the long run. To give the very simple example, which is very close to the hearts of all Chinese and Asian people, is the problem of population. What on earth are we going to do about that? Because in times past, the huge populations of India and China were pruned by perennial outbreaks of cholera and other diseases which wiped out millions of people, famines, and so the population was pruned. Now, however, with the methods of modern medicine, we begin to stamp out these plagues, but then a new plague turns up in the form of human beings. Too many of them. Well, you can't go around in cold blood shooting down people or getting rid of people who you regard as not making up to certain standards. It was somehow better if the cholera did it, because that was impersonal and it bore you no spite. But when human beings have to decide to get rid of each other, then there's real trouble. So a Taoist would be, on the whole, inclined not to interfere with the course of events, because he feels that they are of a complexity so great that he, with his verbal interpretations, because all that we call scientific knowledge is a verbal interpretation of what's going on, and of certain selection of things that we call good and a selection of certain things that we call bad. Well, he feels that he doesn't really know in terms of words whether a given event is good or bad. He may feel badly about it, but he may feel that this is the proper and appropriate way to feel in such circumstances, and that it will go over. It will pass. For as Lao Tzu said, the fierce gale does not last the whole morning, nor does pelting rain go on all day. Maybe he hadn't lived in Big Sur. But still, in general, then he goes on to say, if heaven and earth cannot keep up these things for long, how much less can mankind? So this then is a basic attitude in Taoist philosophy, which goes by the name of Wu Wei. And that is this. That means Wu, that means negative, and Wei. Wei means doing, interfering, busyness, poking into things. So Wu Wei means don't interfere, don't strive. Really, the best meaning of Wu Wei is don't force it. As when, for example, you're opening a lock and the key doesn't seem to turn. If you force it, you'll just bend the key. So what you have to do is jiggle, pull back and forth, jiggle, 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 until you find the place where the key turns. And that's Wu Wei. Wu Wei doesn't mean total passivity. Because, you see, on the other side of the picture,